Somebody he met who had a trick-or-treater come by last night. He's a little older than the average trick-or-treater, and he just, the guy standing there with a baseball hat on, not dressed up any other way, a baseball hat, and he had one maple leaf hanging off the bill of his cab. The guy said he just opened the door, and he's surprised to see a guy standing there. He finally thought to ask, well, what are you? And he said, a leaf blower. So, I guess that was it. Who were the old-time visitors we had here? Gerald, was that you, Gerald? It's good to have you guys here, and also Sister Boots here. We're glad to have everybody else with us tonight. I want to mention a couple of our families that we didn't get any announcements. Remember that Marlene Matthews, Eileen's daughter, is still not in good health. We want to remember her. And also Lonnie and Wanda. Wanda is doing the rehab every day. I think Eddie's taking Lonnie over there and then picking him up every day, and remember them. And also Bill's family, your sister's memorial is Saturday, is that okay? So remember her, and everybody remember, I think, you have to get up at 2 o'clock Saturday night and set your clock, what is it, back an hour? So you can get up at 2 and go to bed at 1. How's that? Go back to bed at 1. That is fast. And I know you'll remember to do that. Gerald, how are our brothers and sisters in the Houston area doing after all of the storm?
Doing very well. It's been a slow process, but still making progress. There's still several emergency workers there working out of our church building. We fed over 5,000 from there, and thanks to good congregations like you folks, we've received about $300,000 to be distributed in the area. About 30 families have been affected by the water and the
from the League City Church or from... Wow.
Progress is being made. We appreciate your physical health as well as the prayers in our behalf.
I know that must be quite a deal. Did you guys do the disaster relief people from your building there, or was that just you guys do it?
No, it was not only us, but others came in there. Okay. Came in probably 15 or 20 of those, and we distributed all of that too.
Well, we appreciate y'all's work. Carrie, our daughter's husband took 50 university students from Abilene to Beaumont over the. They had a fall break into last week, and did that. If I understood her right, they mucked out just 3 houses, and they worked, you know, they worked around the clock, but it is such a mess in some of those places that it's going to take a long time. Well, to our class now. This quarter in this class, we are studying what the Bible tells us about heaven, and we're trying to. It's, of course, beyond our view in some way. I wonder if any of you sitting in this class have seen, I'm not sure what channel it is or anything like that. I've seen Kay watching it. Fixer Upper. Have you seen that show, any of you? Okay. They buy, the way they say it, the worst house in the best neighborhood, and they fix it up to be a family's dream place. And the times when I've seen it, I don't know if they do this all the time, but they lead you through the whole purchase of the choosing of the place, the purchasing of it, the designing of it, the remodeling of it, redoing of it. And then they get you right down to the last 5 minutes or so, and they bring this couple out that they've done all of this for, and you're excited to see what the outcome is and all of that. And it says, are you ready to see your fixer-upper? And, oh, yes, oh, yes. And they go to break. Have y'all seen that? Then they bring you back, and they have this great big picture of what it was before they started. And that's the people are standing out here in front of the place, and you just see this big, big picture in two parts, and they finally pull it back and you see what's there. When we're thinking about heaven, for the previous two classes and this one, We've tried to take notice of the way the New Testament uses the concept of glory, our inheritance of glory, and the glory that's beyond comparison with the present sufferings, and the glory that's to be revealed, that type of thing. And then we've broadened the scope a bit, and we noticed that in the whole Bible, the idea of God's glory is representative of His greatness, such that man wants to see it, but no man can see the fullness of God's glory or the face of God and live. We found that out with Moses in Exodus 33, for example, and other places like that. So that tells us that to speak of our final inheritance as glory is to be in a spot where we can appreciate how God really is. Bill, are you? Okay, and I was going to mention last week we tried to show that there are some things that cannot exist in the presence of God's glory, and therefore, remember, these are the beneficial absences from heaven, as we talked about. Now, Bill, what would you want to say?
I made a statement in there some time ago, a few weeks back. Heaven is a prepared place for a prepared people. I have to change that. We cannot prepare for what heaven is.
Well, God can get us ready for it. While He's getting a place ready, He can get a people ready. And we wouldn't be in a position to take it all in. In fact, that's kind of what I want to start with. If nobody can see the glory in the face of God in this present human circumstance, then it will have to be communicated to us by comparison. You guys back there may have to help me move this along. It's not click. All right. So it'll have to be communicated by means of comparisons. Now, we do this kind of thing a lot. Some of you guys who have been to some other land, like if you ask Gerald to tell you what Romania is like, he might pick out a part of the land in the middle of Missouri somewhere and point that out and say it looks like that. It would be comparison, you see. So with the glory that's to be revealed for us, what God reveals about it to us, He must do by means of comparisons, because we're not in a position to take it in otherwise. And we can also say that we won't be able to out-imagine it. If you get what I'm getting at. This heaven, the final glory of God's people will be such that we may misimagine it. We may imagine it to be something other than what it is. But we will not compose in our minds a bigger picture of it than it actually can be. Does that make sense to you? I brought with me something I read in a Spiritual Sword magazine probably 40 years ago. And I've kept it all this time. It was a piece by Brother G.C. Brewer. Apparently a sermon transcribed from him way back. And he was commenting, commenting about the view of heaven that someone might have. And he says, we can say that we have a figurative description of it without in any way indicating that we don't believe the details that we have about it in Scripture. And he says, certainly the home of the soul will be equal in beauty, majesty, and glory to the description that the Bible has of it. And it will go even far beyond anything the mortal mind can grasp. He says, the joy of heaven is equal and goes far beyond any impressions that we receive or any emotions of joy that are stirred in our souls by the description. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. Heaven will not be lesser than what we may imagine it to be. And so I want to take the third step in this little part of this series on the glory to be revealed in us or to us, and focus tonight on if it's glory, and if there's some things that can't be in glory, that won't be there, then what will be present because the glory of God is present? I hope that kind of let you see where we're headed with this. I want to go to Revelation 21 to think about this. And I have a comment or two to start with here about this passage. I'm aware of the different impressions of this passage that people have and of some of the discussions that go on about it. I'm choosing this because in verse 11 of Revelation 21, we have this city coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. And its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. Now, obviously, that's what we're interested in. What would it be to be in the city that has the glory of God? I want to ask you to consider for a second what it is exactly that's being described here. And here are the two main things I have heard suggested in answer to that question. First, obviously, a lot of people will just take Revelation 21:22 and say, well, that's heaven. That's describing that place. And I've also run across a number of people who say, no, this is describing the glory of the church. This is the bride of Christ. And it might be that we would want to fine-tune either of those two answers just a bit. And that's what I'd like to suggest. And all of this that we'll say tonight, we suggest with humility. I'm not claiming that I have all the answers to this, but I do want to start us on a line of thought. And I hope it'll be helpful to you in that way. Notice when you look at this passage, what happens actually in verses 9 and 10. John, in verse 9, he refers to one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. And for those of you readers of Revelation, that'll take you to the last several chapters of this book, and you'll know that this was the judgments that came in answer to the prayers of the persecuted saints. And this time, this angel says to John, "Come, I will show you," what? "The bride, the wife of the Lamb." Now, this is something that we have already met in Revelation 19 and verses, really verses 6 through 10, but especially in verses 8 and 9, along in there. The rejoicing is going on because of the marriage of the Lamb has come, verse 7, and his bride has made herself ready. And she's dressed, she's clothed herself in fine linen, and this fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints, it says in verse 8. Verse 9 pronounced those blessed who've been invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb, and then worship follows in the wake of that. So we pick up that thought back over here in Revelation 21 now. "Come and I'll show you the bride." And he carried me, verse 10, he carried me away in spirit to a great high mountain, and showed me what? The holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So I'm going to show you the bride. You turn and look, and you see the city. And so if you think about this and what exactly is being described, I suggest this answer, that what we are about to read is a description of the experience of the people of God in glory, more than it's a description of the place. And I know that there's a fine distinction perhaps to make, but what I'm getting at is, yes, there are images, illustrations, symbols used in what we're about to read, and they are spoken of the city, but the city is actually a way of our understanding the experience of the victorious people of God. And just like last week, what we read that's not in this city meant that in the experience of the victorious people of God, there's no death, no mourning, no crying, no pain, etc. That now there are some things that will be an experience of the people of God because of their being in the presence of God's glory. And if you can think of it that way with me, then when we look at what happens following here, we'll get an idea of what there is in the presence of God's glory. Look at down at verse 23, which I have mentioned here. In verse 23, it says, "The city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for," what? "The glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb." So that's why I look at this and think that we're being told of what it's like to live in the light of the glory of God. So we kind of proceed that way. And here, and I haven't, This is my effort to read these verses and to summarize them, and I hope you take it that way. If we're describing the experience of people, of the Lord's victorious people, the ones who are in His glory, what's it like? Number one, it is the experience of complete freedom. complete freedom where you don't have to worry about invaders or terrorists or thieves or oppressors or whatever, but also friendship and fellowship among people that you have everything in common with. And the reason I describe it this way, look at verses 12 through 14 now. Remember, this is the city that has the glory of God. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel are inscribed. On the east, 3 gates. On the north, 3 gates. On the south, 3 gates. On the west, 3 gates. And on the wall of the city, and the wall of the city had 12 foundations. And on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, this city having the high wall and the gates would have been a way of speaking about security and freedom from any of the threats that might try to storm the walls of a city in the ancient world or break through the gates and work harm on the citizens of that city. None of that. And the reason I include the idea of fellowship here is gates have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the foundations, which are sufficient, have the names of the 12 apostles, indicating, I think, the people of God, Old Testament and New Testament, and suggesting that here is where the people of God are present in fellowship and freedom according to God's promise and God's will and God's purpose. So to be in the presence of God's glory would at least be those two things. To be in the presence of God's glory would be, come on, clicker, here we go. I've used terms to try to describe not only the beauty of something, but the response to it that the human personality might make. Perfect splendor, and then wonder at it. And I'll try to do this without reading the whole section for the sake of time, but look at verse 18 and what we have here. This city built four square as if in perfection, and I suggest the 144 cubit idea fits with the 12 apostles times 12 tribes, and that what we're being told is not the distance within a city physically, but instead there's a place for all of God's people to belong here. And in verse 18, the city wall is built of jasper. Most of the suggestion is the closest thing we have to that would be diamond. And while the city was pure gold, like clear glass. Now, if I'm on the right track here and ask you to think about the experience of the people, then you can easily see that we're not talking about a place made out of these substances. We're talking instead about what kind of experience it would be to be there. And you think of the splendor of it and the wonder at it. Verse 19, the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. And it names all of them here, and all these different colors. I don't even know what some of them are, But I can tell they must be beautiful, and you would see them and you'd think, wow. And then verse 21, the 12 gates are 12 pearls, each made of a single pearl. And the street, notice it just says the street, it's not a city with streets. The street was pure gold, like transparent glass. I'm not sure what grade of gold that would, that'd be something. I'd say I can look at that and say, "Wow, I've seen some beautiful places, but I haven't seen anything like that." And I can tell in looking at this that every kind of term that can be used to say this is a place of majesty or an experience of majesty is being used to tell us what it would be like to be in the presence of God's glory. In this experience is also the presence of everything that is good or honorable that there ever has been in human life or human experience. Look at verse 24. It says, "By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it." Now, whether their glory means their power or their wealth or the splendor that some of the kings of the ancient world amassed in terms of clothing and crowns and jewels and all such thing, I don't know. But all of that that could be counted honorable or worthy. And then verse 26 adds, "They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations." The glory that would be in the presence of God, or what that glory would be like, will not be less than any of the glory of any king, no matter how powerful, or of any man, no matter how wealthy it could ever be. I don't know what's been the most impressive location you have ever experienced, but you'd say this experience goes so far beyond that it's unimaginable. Then in the presence of God's glory, there would be the fulfillment of any thirst for life that any one of us ever might know or have. What are the things that make you thirst for life? Be honest, when you watched the news last night, did it make you thirsty for the time when there wouldn't be that kind of ugly stuff ever happen? Bill?
I have to think about it. It's hard for human beings to grasp it, but that will be a place where there is complete absence of evil.
Yeah. It's hard to grasp, but it's not hard to desire, is it? Yeah. And you think of it when in different ways we get news of our own mortality and we thirst for life. When we see the pain of broken relationships, what people go through, the agony, the heartbreak, it's not hard to thirst for life. And we see young people hurt or abused or confused, it's not hard to thirst for life, real life. And in this passage, more than once, this idea is touched on. Chapter 21, back up at verse 6, where God said at the end of that verse, "To the thirsty I will give from the fountain or the spring of the water of life. I'll give to the thirsty from this spring without payment or freely." I love to think of an Ozark spring when I read, what's the biggest spring you've been to? And you see the water bubbling up out of the ground. And you read, which one is it?
Big Spring.
Big Spring, all right, that would be the biggest one. I thought sure you were going to say the one at Roaring River or something. David lived right down there. You think of that, though, the perpetual bubbling up of cold, clear, pure water, and what that would be like if you were from an arid world like these folks were. But think of it in the sense of the deeper things of life. And then at 22:1, it says, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life." If one picture is the spring, then there's the river that starts and flows from it, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. It's free, and it is a fountain, and it turns into a river, and it flows right through the middle of the place. It's every way it can to tell you have access to the satisfaction of the thirst for life or the fulfillment of it. And then, I got my watch laid down and I'm looking at my wrist. It doesn't work that way, does it? Then the next thing is to be in the presence of God's glory would mean the perpetual satisfaction and healing. You and I are familiar maybe with momentary satisfaction in our life, but there's always another task or another responsibility or the next meal to eat or the next day or whatever it is. But in the picture that's used here, God, to be in the presence of God's glory would be the remedy for what was broken when man sinned and had to hide from God. And the remedy for what happened when God had to exclude man from the tree of life. Verse 2 says, after the part about the river in the middle of the street, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And that's why I say that this is a way of telling us that it's always abundant in providing for the need. And then the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So to satisfy and to make well. And then this is to be in the presence of God's glory would be the place where the experience of the perfect, total rule of God from the throne and of the Lamb. You know, in the model prayer, Matthew 6, the Lord taught us to pray, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So this would appear to be the final fulfillment of that desire. It says in verse 3, if you look at it, "No longer will there be anything accursed." We talked about that a bit last week. "But the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it." And the throne would mean the sovereign rule of God, or the perfect rule of God, and His servants will worship Him. And then I remember I've tried to summarize this in my words, but skip down to 22:14, and you notice here the total sense of well-being and belonging, and this would always tend to go with the fulfillment and the satisfaction and the submission to God's rule that we've talked about. blessed are those who wash their robes or who do his commandments, some of the manuscripts say, so that they may have the right to the tree of life and that they may enter the city by its gates. To have the tree of life would be the well-being, and to enter the city by its gates would be to belong there and not be a stowaway. Now, these are, how many of these are there? There are seven of these that we've mentioned, and this would be a way of thinking about the experience of God's people in glory. It would be a fine thing if it were just a description of the place, and maybe it is in some ways, but the experience of God's people there, that makes it to me the even more meaningful thing. I want to mention three things that I notice in this context that are said of God's people in his presence. One, they see his face. And if I said they are forever learning of his glory, would I be far off there to see his face? Moses wanted to see his glory. God told him, "You can't see my face and live." If you see his face, you are learning of his glory. So that might be a way of thinking about this. Secondly, we're told that the God's servants worship him. They offer, and this is the word, the term for worship that involves priestly service. Back in chapter 7 and verse 15, it talked about them being at God's throne and serving him day and night. So this would only be something that would be understandable if you and I have gotten in our minds the thought of the joy of doing something for someone that you admire and appreciate. To get to do something, my little grandkids are not old enough yet, but what they still are glad to do something for me. They seem to take joy in it, unless I ask them to give me their candy or something, you know. But if you think of the privilege of doing something good for someone that you admire, someone that you want to be around, that would be the privilege here. I've run across people, I wouldn't want to go to heaven if it were just going to be a church service, as if it would be, if I tell them there won't be a sermon there, then it gets more interesting to them. You be able to see God face to face, you won't need somebody to preach to you about it. You can sing to him then. All right, and then this passage uses the idea of reigning forever and ever. Now, of course, the temptation is to simply want to make this a 1,000-year deal and to rule over everybody else on the earth. In the scheme of Revelation, if you take this term here as enjoying victory forever, I think we'd be on the right track. This has been about overcoming. This book has been about overcoming. And this would be a way of saying to these people who've overcome, you're never again going to be a challenged one who might not overcome. The overcoming is done. That was the idea. All right. I appreciate you bearing with me tonight. I hope that this is something that grabs our attention. I want us to think a little bit next week about the other images that are used in the New Testament for the experience of the people of God besides glory. And I'm going to try to combine the others in one study so you kind of know where we headed. Any other announcements that we needed to make before we go? Again, thanks to everybody. It's good to have guests with us.